So this is the start of our approaches to wisdom theme. And we had Parinirvana Day falling at the start. And I guess we just thought, well, let's roll Parinirvana Day in with the wisdom theme, because it is a day of reflection. And it's Parinirvana. Basically, pari means sort of, I think, after. And nirvana means enlightenment. So it's like enlightenment without residual, enlightenment with nothing left behind. So when the Buddha died, it was his parinirvana. The last kind of connection to the world was sort of left behind. He would not take rebirth again, in another language. And interestingly enough, Buddhists celebrate parinirvana. The fact that the Buddha died is a kind of quite a vivid sort of example that everybody dies, and even the Buddha. Yeah, there's a line from the threefold puja that we do in the thing that says, just as the Buddha was born, we are born. And in my mind this afternoon, I thought, just as the Buddha dies, we will die. You know, what the Buddha attained, we too can attain. You could flip it. So we and the Buddha are in similar predicament. And just like we were born and die, he was born and died. So I was going to talk a little bit about the Buddha's final days. And then I was going to talk a little bit about reflections on impermanence and reflections on death from a Buddhist perspective, and how they're not morbid at all, but what they're trying to do is to release us from preoccupations, not necessarily about death, but maybe about life and trying to cling to life and cling to youth and cling to health. So I'm going to kind of approach that little. And then what I was hoping to do was to go over the shrine room and do these reflections. Yep, for about a half an hour. And then after we do the reflections, to finish with just a short threefold puja. And so that's the evening I have planned. So if you do need to, I know lots of people they like to listen to the talk, but then they like to get home and sort themselves out and stuff. I would encourage you to stay for the whole evening tonight, because I think it'll be a whole package, but I won't take it personally if you skip out, unless I'm the only one left there, and then I will take it personally. Yeah. So, with the Buddha's last days, I guess a couple things. The Buddha taught into his 80s. He was an old man and was starting to feel the aches and pains of old age. And you can find it in the Pali Canon. You know, there's times when he sends his attendant Ananda to go get some milk because he's got like an upset stomach. I mean, he was still subject to the frailty of the human body. The fact that he was awakened in enlightenment didn't change the fact that he had a human body. Yeah. And in those final days, he got food poisoning and was also trying to visit everybody, kind of all the people he taught, try to make a final sort of visit. And what he taught predominantly, I think, is interesting. He taught predominantly the threefold path, which is the path of meditation, ethics, and wisdom. And that was kind of what he taught. Just like if you go through those last days in the Pali Canon, you just get the threefold path, which the Noble Eightfold Path is easily mapped into that framework. Yep. So the threefold path and Noble Eightfold Path, you can kind of combine the two and make sense of them. But at that time in his life, he was teaching the threefold path. And another thing he taught was right on his deathbed, he basically said, with mindfulness, strive on. And I like to bring this up because the translation of the Pali word, which is apramada, is mindfulness. But mindfulness can be misleading with what the Buddha is actually saying for his final teaching to us and to the people then. Because apramada is a particular form of mindfulness. Apramada is heedfulness. You know, it's to not be heedless. So he's saying, care about your mind. Yeah, care about your mind and be wary of where your mind is and whether it's flavored with craving, hatred, and a lack of attentiveness or delusion. Yeah, he's saying, care about that. Pay attention to that. Yeah, so that's the mindfulness he's asking you to strive on for. It's an awareness of whether your mind is possessed by skillful emotions or unskillful emotions. So the skillful emotions would be generosity, care, mindfulness. Yeah, and he wants us to care about that. And the reason he wants us to care about it is because when our minds are flavored with craving and aversion, and when we're distracted and not attending, we can't know reality. We can't know reality because we're kind of distracted. We're obsessed with other aspects of it. We're not actually a suitable vessel in a way for reality to be revealed, to see clearly. Because we're sort of, we've got veils across our eyes. Yeah? Veils of the passions, for example. So that's the virtue of kind of looking, kind of, and trying to keep as much as you can, trying to cultivate mental states which are generous and kind and attentive, because you actually have a better chance of experiencing what's really going on around you. So with mindfulness strive on, those were his last words, with mindfulness strive on. One of the other things that's interesting about those last days is they asked him, well, what do you want us to do when you die? Do you want us to kind of plant a tree on you, or should we kind of cremate you? The Tibetans do sky cremations. Whoa, heavy. Yeah, they take your body, they chop it up, and they feed it to vultures. I kind of think that's kind of cool. You know? But what?
If you're a vulture.
If you're a vulture, yeah. But supposedly, when the Buddha was asked how he wanted to be remembered, he folded up a robe and into a square and placed his begging bowl on top of it. And it was said that was the first stupa. There's a couple stupas. They've all been moved into the shrine room, but Pundarikini's made a shrine up with some of the different Parinirvana images, and the stupa is very much related to marking someone's death in Buddhism. So we've got the stupa at Sudarshanaloka, which just this past weekend we were down celebrating, and in that stupa there are the ashes of Dharma Rinpoche, which was one of Sangharakshita's teachers. And so that stupa, it's not that stupa sort of represent or marks Dharma Rinpoche's death. That stupa with his ashes in there, as Sangharakshita says, is Dharma Rinpoche. You know, the stupa has that significance of sort of almost being like an antenna into the world of all those qualities of those people that have departed. Now you might, who knows what you think, who knows what you believe, but when people go around that stupa, they frequently go around that stupa and they do feel a sense of reverence and respect. They feel that there's a different energy up there. Now granted, it's got a beautiful view, and it's big, kind of white, huge stupa, kind of sitting overlooking the Thames, the water that comes through there. So there's just a bit of a natural awe with the vista and stuff. But I think also when you go up there, it's worth trying to cultivate a bit of receptivity to what might be or what could be, just opening yourself up and just seeing the difference between open and closed. And it comes back to that whole thing about with mindfulness strive on. You know, if we've are really attached to views about how the world is and how the world isn't, then it'll be difficult for us to see beyond those views. Yeah? So there's a really great experiment that they do, which it doesn't work so well these days, but the principle keeps working and they keep shifting it to make the point. But There's a bunch of people in a room that are passing balls back and forth. Some of them are dressed in white, some are dressed in black. There's three people on each team. And what you're asked to do is to watch the people passing the ball and count how many times the ball is passed. So when you watch this, you want to get it right. You want to be right, don't you? You don't want to be wrong. So you concentrate. And because you're concentrating, you're watching the ball go back and forth. And these people, they're moving. But you know, you're thinking, I can do this. You know, I can do this. I can watch how many times the ball's passed around. And so at the end of it, they say, okay, how many times was the ball passed around? And you know, and you say, 17. And they say, yeah, 17. Very good. But did you see the dancing gorilla that walked through the middle of the event? And no, people don't. They don't see the dancing gorilla. So then they go, let's rewind it and show you again. And literally, this dancing gorilla walks onto the stage in the middle of it, looking at you, kind of goes, you know, and then walks off. And you didn't see it. Yeah. And since then, they've found that it's, you know, people do start to see the dancing gorilla for some reason. I don't know why, but it's almost like, I don't know, something happens. But then what they did was they started taking people out of the team. Like, there'd be three people throwing the ball, but then all of a sudden there were just two. Or the background changes from red to orange. And basically, if you're concentrating on something, you just miss those things. So I think when you're concentrating with passion, you miss things. And but also it's views too. It's like, what's the view you bring to it? So trying to be open around these things, trying to be receptive around stupas. So when the Buddha folded up his robe and put the begging bowl on top, that was the start of stupas, and they've kind of advanced and whatever. They've changed and become more elaborate. But that was another thing that happened in the last days of the Buddha. And then he died. He died, and you know, after his death, you know, there was almost a riot over the ashes because all sorts of people show up and they all want a bit of the Buddha. You can just imagine it. You know, everybody wants a thigh bone, don't they? And you know, it was good that kind of that just went its way. I don't think the monks kept anything. I don't think any of his followers kept anything. I think it's just split up by all the kings that wanted a bit of it. But he did leave us with that last example of death. So when we reflect on death, it's not a morbid kind of like get it into your thick skull that you're going to die reflection. Yeah, it's not meant around that or to kind of remind us that life is suffering. It's not around that. It's basically to get us to let go of the assumption that we can live forever. Yeah? And by letting go of that, and also letting go of the assumption that other people will live forever. So in that way, having a more relaxed maybe, or let us say realistic kind of approach to what's happening around us. You know, people die. Sujiva just had a friend in Australia whose wife died quite suddenly. I remember when I was at university, my roommate's girlfriend's father died of just a freak kind of heart attack in his 40s. It happens, you know? And it's not that it just happens to certain people who don't take care of themselves. It happens to everybody. You know, it's always a possibility, you know? And if you kind of have that possibility, then in a way, say for example with death, you know, a lot of people regret not having cleaned up their grievances with people, you know, particularly with parents. You can kind of have grievances with parents that you don't clear up and then they die. But a lot of times it's because we think that we've got lots of time to do it. You know, we think that, well, you know, there will be time to sort that out, you know. Or we might think there'll be time to sort out our own practice. You know, it's like, oh, well, I'm not going to practice now. I'll wait till I finish my job and then I've retired. And then once I've retired, the kids will be in college and I'll have lots of time and I'll be able to meditate more. But right now I can't do it because it's just too busy. But what happens when you retire and the kids leave is that you didn't count on old age. Yeah? And so you get to that point in your life and actually you don't have the physical stamina you had in your 30s and 40s. Yeah, you just don't have it. Or maybe you didn't count on the fact that you would get sick. That illness is something, and this is something I'm kind of struggling with, and you know, I don't mean to sound like, you know, kind of, I know what illness and old age are all about, but over the last, I'm 50, and over the last 10 years, I've just watched my body not be so good at rebounding from rebounds. You know, so when I bump into something, I don't really just pop back up again. It's like I bump into something and it's like, oh, you know, I got a kink for a day. You know, the cartilage is a bit stiffer. It's not quite as flexible. My knees hurt a bit more going up and down steps. And, you know, that could keep going. But, you know, if you put everything off, kind of thinking that your youth will last forever, it's just not the case. So when we reflect on death, and when we reflect on illness, and we reflect on old age, in a way, what we're trying to do is let go of the idea that we will always be young, healthy, and vibrant. That's really what it's about. It's not about, yeah, that's what it's about. And therefore, since we're not always going to be like that, take advantage of your life. You know, use it now. Yeah, kind of practice now. Do the things that are important now. Sort out differences you've got with people now. If they're important enough to do in 5 years, if they're in your mind, do them now. Do them next week. Do them next month. Kind of, you know, sort those things out. They say that on your deathbed, no one ever regrets that they didn't work harder. Yeah, but everybody regrets not having done the things that they really wanted to do in life. Everybody regrets not having spent more time with friend and family. You know, those things they do regret. You know, people regret not having sorted things out. I was really impressed with Taranatha. He spent the last couple years really sorting out his relationship to his children. He was an alcoholic. And by his own confession, he wasn't a great parent at times. But he saw that, and he worked really hard to change it. And his girls didn't really want to kind of change that for many years. But he just kept staying with them. He just kept staying with them. And by the time he died, I think he'd managed to transform all those relationships. Which, to be quite honest, is really beautiful. You know, really, really beautiful. So, in a way, he used to reflect on death all the time. So that's what reflecting on death can give us, is that beauty to change what we can now and to make our life meaningful now. That's what it's about. So there's a reflection that the Buddha advises or recommends in the Pali Canon, which are called the five reflections for everyone. And I thought we'd do that tonight. So the five reflections are, I am not immune to aging. Yeah, so I will grow old. Yeah, I'm not immune to illness. So I am susceptible to illness. I am not immune from death. Yeah, I've got a reading that we'll do in the puja, which is a letter from Kukai, who's a Buddhist practitioner, to a nobleman in Kyoto. And he says some line in there a bit like, you know, no one's ever managed to live forever. Thousands and thousands and millions of beings have died. Not a single one has managed to not die. It's just like, it's phenomenal when you think about it. I was on a helicopter flying above Melbourne once, and there's a huge cemetery in Melbourne, And visually, when you watch it from above, you realize how big of an area of space it is. You know, it's vast. And you just think, that's filled with dead people. You know, it's like, the kind of the dead are many, the living are few sort of statement. So, either way, so the third reflection is death. The fourth reflection is separation from what I love. Yeah? We're not immune from that. It's sort of to imagine that we'll never be separated from what we love is to actually, almost in a way, to deny the top three. Because things change. People move on. People change. It's like if we try and hold on to things, it just won't, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. We might be lucky. They might be in our life for our whole life. That's great. I wish that for everybody. I wish for everybody in this room that you're never separated from what you love. I really do. And it might be possible. And wouldn't that be beautiful? But you're not going to have that happen by clinging hold of it. Yeah, you're not going to have that happen by locking your doors down, by chaining things up. That's probably not going to keep you together with things you love for the rest of your life. And the fifth reflection is my future is built from my actions. And my actions kind of create my world. And this is the reflection on karma. And in a way, this reflection is about agency. This is realizing that, yeah, okay, maybe I can't sort of kind of demand that everything I love never leaves me. Maybe I can't fight old age. Maybe I can't fight kind of youth, and I can't fight illness. Well, I can't hold on to youth or avoid illness. But what I can do is I can kind of create as positive a mind state as I possibly can, and I can make sure that my actions are as positive and as skillful as I can. And if you do that, in a way, you create a world that's as good as it can be, because you're striving on with mindfulness. You're making that choice that your mind is going to be flavored by care, generosity, and attentiveness. And if you do those things, your life will work out, you know, as best it can. It's the most positive thing we can do to make our life work out well. So in this reflection that you do, you basically, the next thing you do is you just kind of, in a way, once you've thought about, say, for example, old age, you think about kind of how alluring, intoxicating youth can be. And you try and realize that when you're trying to cling hold of youth, when you're trying to hold on to it and not realizing that you can't, you know, it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of energy to avoid wrinkles as you get older. If you put a lot of time into avoiding wrinkles, it's going to cost a lot of money and going to be a lot of heartache, yeah? Because you can't do it. We can't do it, yeah? I'm afraid I've got a gut. I was just like, oh, man. I'd love to have like a, you know, six-pack flat stomach. But one is, I couldn't have that when I was 22. You know? The amount of effort it would take for me to try and have that is so high. But at the same time, when I look at the mirror and I see my rotundness, yeah, it's sort of like there is a bit of me that kind of is upset because I'm not young anymore, because I'm actually, you know, there's a bit of me that's kind of upset, but I'm not going to cry. but you know, to the extent that I can just sort of let go of that and just realize that, well, that is what happens. That's the aging process. That's what happens. It's sort of like I free myself of all that activity which is trying to fight against that. And freeing myself from all the activity that's fighting against it is liberating. Completely liberating. Yep. So then you reflect on, you can reflect on that, the liberation of just kind of letting go of the quest for eternal youth. But just like you're subject to all these things, everybody else is too. And this is where the Buddha's death is so important, because the Buddha didn't kind of go to some magnificent place where only Buddhas go and, you know, you're free from all these things. The Buddha you know, passed away. So there is no escape from separation. There is no escape from old age in this world. Yeah. But if you can kind of realize that there's no escape from these things, and there's no kind of eternal youth, there's no eternal life, there's no eternal health, well, then what you can do is you can start putting your effort into what actually, in a way, can go beyond space and time. You know, you start putting your effort into the things that are meaningful and that will continue to be meaningful at your death and will continue to be meaningful even beyond your death. Yeah? So things like kindness tend to just amplify as you get older. I remember it was one of the things that really struck me about Bhadrachitta was that as she got older, she almost glowed more brightly. I don't know how that was, but it was almost like she just became more joyful. And in fact, she was predicted to die in a couple months, and she ended up living for a year plus, I think. And she, you know, it was almost like, I mean, her family, you know, kind of came up and they took her on a van trip down to Christchurch, Queenstown, which is where they live. And it's almost like they got down there and she was having such a good time, they just continued driving around. You know, and I think if there was one quality that Bhadrachitta really had, it was joy and love. She just radiated joy and love, joy and love, joy and love. And it's just like no matter what her body was doing, her body was breaking down. But it's almost as if the joy or love, it sort of got kind of released. It almost got kind of liberated more. Yeah, it was just phenomenal. And yeah, so I think, either way, stop with that one. So, that's my talk. That's kind of the words I wanted to give in preparation for the meditation we'll do. So it's about 20 till, and for those of you that kind of, you know, like to head off and be home, if we had a tea break, you'd get out at 8:20. If we go in the shrine room in the next, we'll have a tea break for 15 minutes or so to get a drink, but we'll go back in the shrine room by like 5 till, yeah? A half an hour meditation, and then probably like a 20-minute sort of threefold puja means that you're out of here by 8:45. What a deal. So, not that I'm trying to sell anything to you, but, you know, just wanted to point out the attractive timings. So, we'll have a tea break, and I'll ring a bell for the second half of the evening. Thanks.